All right, well, first of all, I want to thank you all for coming, and it's so great to have so many guests here. How's the conference going? Yeah? A1? It's because of Alan. I think we should give him a round of applause. Well, I did something that I don't often do, and that is I actually wrote a real intro. Normally I just read bios, but Alan's was so crazy, I thought, let's take time and write a little intro. All right. I remember the first time I heard Alan Shelton perform his work. It was several years ago at a literary Buffalo reading event. I watched as Alan transformed the restless room into attentive silence. The tattered sepia photographs around his feet, his voice stitching sacred ground to cursed sky. Forgotten zigzagged to remembered. How we leaned forward in our chairs to listen, turning our eyes away. How his words suddenly became our memory, too. I knew this man was haunted, but by what demons? Do you hear that rusty saw gnawing through the tangle of wisteria branches? Voices crying out in tongues? The Holy Spirit lying curled in a heap on the floor? Barbed wire quietly stretched and twisted, twisted and spliced, spliced and stretched? That evening, we were simultaneously mesmerized and terrified. Years later, I call this ghost man a poet, a truth teller, truth seeker, and truth slayer, professor of sociology, student of hard knocks, jack of little known trades, preacher, heavyweight champ, fence mender, sheep shearer, historian, palm reader, folklorist, gourmet cook, and always, always a Southern gentleman. Please welcome my good friend and colleague, Dr. Alan Shelton.
I think all that is true except the sheep shearer.
I never know what's true, Alan.
I want to thank Lisa and the Rooftop Poetry Club for having me here. I really appreciate it, and for the people who've come. And I have a small surprise for Lisa as well. I take it that was my surprise.
Yeah, the surprise.
She's doing my gig. It's a little embarrassing when she does it better than me. But I have a small surprise for her, and it's about why I'm not a poet. And so I went back and found a poem I wrote when I was 17 years old. And this will be the only poetry that I perform today. And now you'll know why I'm not a poet. I can't pronounce my title any longer, but Lawrence is here, and he might. And it means the hidden name of God, Tetragrammaton. Did I say it right?
That's it, perfect.
So here I was, a very heady 17-year-old, going, Tetragrammaton. And this is what I wrote when I was 17. My father was an alchemist. He sold me for gold before I was born. At night, the Pharaoh's daughters came in bone masks and with irons and straightened my arms, rubbing oil into the shoulder joints, and then dropped me into my sleep, turned inside out into a pyramid into the dark. Falling, my crew cut glistened. That's why I became a sociologist. And I'm only going to do a piece of the thing out of Dream Worlds of Alabama. And I'm doing that as a sort of dedication to Molly and to her influence on the text. And before I do that, I also want to thank Lawrence, who, if I could have seen into the future and known that he knows my book better than I, and can answer better than I, and that he wrote this book through me, I want to thank Lawrence as well. This is just a small excerpt from Dreamworlds of Alabama. And just before his death at the French-Spanish border, Benjamin was described by his companions on the trek across the mountains as lugging a heavy black briefcase that contained what Benjamin reportedly said was the most important thing to me. I cannot risk losing it. It is the manuscript that must be saved. It's more important than I am. Detained at the border, Benjamin took an overdose of morphine. The briefcase was never recovered, and its contents remain a mystery. If only that briefcase had been a person holding his hand. Benjamin was not particularly physically fit, and the climb exhausted him. Here is where Benjamin needed to be clutched by an angel. His last bit of energy seems to have been expended on that briefcase. What it contained has been the object of intense speculation, but the image of Walter Benjamin as a Santa Claus dressed in a black suit and lugging that briefcase under the September sun sharpens the irony of his death. After his death, the party was allowed to cross the border under the sign of Benjamin's farewell valentine. The surrealist Georges Bataille thought that Benjamin was carrying a version of his history of 19th century Paris, written as a children's story. In it, toys, combs, bodices, pocket knives haunt the passageways through the city and move about while the city sleeps. Against this enchanted sky, an autobiography of Benjamin appears in the unnamed narrator, who, as he goes to sleep, says goodnight to the objects that become alive as he falls asleep. Good night, briefcase. Good night, manuscript. Good night, mustache comb. Good night, doll. Good night, ink bottle. Good night, map of Manhattan. Good night, postcards. Good night, toothbrush. Good night, brogues. Until finally, in the twilight moment, which he's half asleep and they're half awake, he says his last incantation, good night, moon. That's for you, Mom. And I suppose to honor my guests, who I really appreciate, Graham and Karen and Tim and Diana and Jack and Justin, who've come a very long way with no pay, essentially, to be here at Buffalo State. I give you, you know, my heart and what I can. And I'm going to take the enormous risk for you of reading my brand new manuscript, which, as you can say, is going to give me quite a bit of trouble. Just so bear with me. I'm not sure that I can read it myself. And since I'm no longer under the sign of the Holy Ghost, I'm not sure if I can read my own handwriting. This manuscript, and I only have one typed paragraph, is tentatively called How the North Sea Touches Alabama. And you'll recognize a good bit of this. On the 5th of June, Patrick Kine retired to a small room in his apartment that he used as a studio on the west side of Athens, Georgia. The floor and large table were covered with scraps of images, a pair of large scissors, glue, electrical tape, dentures, a pile of old medical journals, butcher knives, and various small objects. He cleared an open space on the floor. He stood upright, engaged how it would appear when he fell. This was something he couldn't help. Patrick was always an artist. The wall directly behind him was bare. He stuck the pistol into his mouth, made a kissing sound, and shot himself. In this, he was successful. The bullet penetrated through the brain and out the top of the skull. He fell, however, just off from the open piece of flooring, obscuring various images with his torso and hips, the blood pooling in the slight dip in the floor. Still, the result was unexpected and very reminiscent of his early work. His body was found 2 days later, making it irrelevant that he had showered and shaved minutes before his departure. That Patrick would leave like this, I had known for years. It was reflected in the construction of his work, particularly in the adhesives that he used. The rubber bands popped and the glue would come unstuck. There was a built-in decay in his work that crept just beneath the surface. When I met Patrick, he was standing next to an installation of his splattered with blood. He shook my hand with his own heavily bandaged hand. It was a gracious act in front of all the broken glass. One of the last communications I had with Patrick was a postcard sent to my farm in Alabama. It was a photograph of the North Sea showing a dark sky and cold, foaming waves with no shore in sight. He had added an image of a bandaged face bobbing in the waves like a buoy, which was then outlined in a rectangle standing upright like an obelisk. At the top of the rectangle was another empty portal or door saved for me. He was unselfish. looking at the postcard, his coming death is as clear and cold as the water rolling in. I'm sure Patrick imagined the bandages in the image, not as staunching the blood, but as a frozen eruption of his brains moving into the world as an iceberg that would vanish into the ocean. A few years after his death, Patrick appeared near my farm. A dozer operator scraping a lake out of a swamp uncovered a 7-foot-long pine coffin. He was so unnerved, he quickly buried it back in the dam. Patrick, like the hunter Gracious, is now touring the world in a sea craft, going wherever the North Sea touches the world beneath the world. I didn't have to ask why he surfaced there. He came to see me. Whether it was Patrick in that craft is questionable, but the coffin wasn't imagined. Mr. Brown, the dozer operator, was still shaken days later when he told me the story. Shelton, it was the damnedest thing I've ever seen. Who would bury someone in a swamp? He pointed to the dam. I put it back in the ground. It's deep now. It isn't coming up again. I ain't never seen him like this before. His voice was stretched. He was fidgeting. He was a short, heavy man and a Baptist. He wasn't superstitious. He was sweating under his cap hat. I'd quit right there if I didn't owe Doug, the lawyer's name, money. Brown's insistence on the permanence of his second burial is probably not well-founded. His knowledge of water was limited. He dug the black dirt out of drained lake bottoms. In this, he was like Patrick. Though he often dressed like a German sailor from the Weimar Republic on shore leave, Patrick had no experience with the sea. He was from a town in the Georgia Piedmont, butting up against the northern edge of the Appalachian Mountains. I'm not even sure he could swim. Oh, dear me. When there's a word like that, I'm just going to say refrigerator. And so, we'll hope that it works as a kind of collage image. Sometimes I'll substitute other words. I think I have it now. Thank you so much for the indulgence. It's ironic, then, that he, like the hunter Gracious, would spend eternity on the water. The body of his work is filled with images of water and liquids. The North Sea, giant slabs of butter melting in chair bottoms. Journal images of men training underwater in concrete pools. A tongue turning into a glossy slime on glass shards. A man dangling from a ship in shark-infested waters. And then the ultimate ocean, a kind of blackness made from electrical tape encircling the Gutenberg Bible. The word void is scratched onto the tape. One of his key signatures was his own blood splattered on objects as a residue of himself left behind, like a cum stain. Here, Patrick drew a line. However replete his work was with strapped erect penises and asparagus spears nudging. Sorry again. Upwards. Towards the Virgin. There is no coming. No semen. Instead, bleeding is coming. Patrick's last gesture was to spray the bare wool behind his head with blood. The small pool that formed in the floor. Refrigerator, like the Red Sea for Moses when his body was moved. The installation Patrick constructed around his death shows an overlapping tendency in his work and life. The first is the desire to turn solids into liquid, and the second is the all-important stain left behind as a marker or thumbprint for the person. It would be stronger to say that Patrick looked for the ocean wherever he was, craning his neck like an ibis in the desert, opening up springs with his scissors. The beginning of the world happened for Patrick in liquid mixed with oceans and blood. Each spill he made a mirror for this sea. Patrick's coffin surfaced in a soft spot in the valley in a piece of beaver swamp that in 1810 stretched for miles in the underbelly of the high woods and mountains. Where Brown built the lake was cut off from the swamp's length by a highway just like a chicken head on a butcher's block. You know, if I could, I would erase that right now and just pretend I didn't read that. Across the highway, AC had pulled the bottom land up of what was called the Warlick Pasture out of the muck with long V-ditches and the extermination of the beavers. A man named Pinky Burns trapped the beavers. What AC accomplished was tenuous. The swamp was just beneath the surface. The bottom was soaked with water. Through with the silt, it felt like honey or something fleshy gorged with blood and fat. It's doubtful if even a supernatural coffin could surface anywhere else but here. The land around the lake was hard-packed, hard as concrete. Holes were chiseled. And there's a slight gap in the manuscript here because I can't read that part at all. And it shifts to the idea of soft spots, other kinds of soft spots. Before my mother Janie died, and there is a family controversy over whether she knew in a year in advance, almost to the day when it would happen, she had written in her diary the 9th of May. She died on Mother's Day, the 12th. But even that date is debated since she wasn't declared dead till the 15th. She put together a photo album for me. The album is a record of me growing up. She had gone through the family archive and separated a band of photographs showcasing me. Only a handful were in color. There were gaps in the record when my father was overseas with the Marine. The years that I spent when I lived apart from my immediate family with my grandparents in Alabama. And then it is thin after I got married. Those photographs are in a box in my ex-wife's garage. The big hole in the album is there are almost no photographs of me on my grandfather AC's farm. Neither my father or mother were part of this world. One of the very few photographs of this world showed me sitting on a pony on the other side of a barbed wire fence, looking like Geronimo in jeans and a crew cut. The farm is the landscape of my childhood, and by the time I was 12, I had lived in 10 different houses scattered across the country. In the 1930s, when it became clear that, like the German emigre Walter Benjamin, who couldn't go home because of his political situation, though just as powerfully it was the deterioration of his personal ties, he produced what he described as an inoculation for homesickness, a series of thought pieces on his childhood in Berlin. Benjamin never went back. He worked on the book up till the suicide on the Spanish border in 1940, continually inoculating himself, continually scratching himself out of the memory. But just as powerfully, the wilderness he found in Berlin as a child manifests itself as an itch, a kind of poison ivy which reproduced the feeling of being lost in the familiar. I expect a little copyright scene now. It's like so fortuitous.
Yeah.
The best passages in a Berlin childhood around 1900 teeter on a vertigo, that moment before being slain in the spirit and falling backwards into what my friend Patrick Kine succinctly called the void. The farm is a memory I keep scratching. And while I have no photographs, I have a cassette tape my cousin made of the farm just as it was being cut off and sold off. AC will die soon. Mary Pullen, my grandmother, will be knocked down in her garden by the compost pile, covered in flies and a mute stroke. My marriage was slipping away, and though I didn't appreciate it then, the world of my childhood was becoming a ghost world, out of reach except for the dead. Listening to the cassette is like hearing a seance. AC is there, Mary Pullen, and me, but different. My girlfriend Molly barely recognizes me. You have a southern accent. For a moment, I sound like I have a home. The tape was produced in 1983 when Matt visited me. He lived 90 miles away in Atlanta. He was a musician and cleaned offices for a living. He was so cool. I envied him. I lived in a ramshackle two-story house with my wife and three big dogs. The house was cold in the winter. The Norwegian wood stove at full tilt could barely keep the inside 20 degrees warmer than the outside. Debbie hated it. In the fall, hundreds of wasps and dirt daubers slipped through the clapboard and down the chimneys into the living room, creating a kind of butterfly arboretum. It wasn't romantic. The farm was done. My grandfather, A.C., had called it quits. The pastures were rented off. The Black Angus were sold to a cowboy from South Alabama. A chicken house was built on one of the back pastures. The sharp ammonia smell moved lazily with the breeze for half a mile or so before petering out. Matt's arrival was on an occasion. Visitors were shy now. Matt had come with a purpose. He had a portable cassette recorder in his coat pocket. His plan was to capture, as if he were an anthropologist, the last days of what we, the grandchildren, called the farm. The farm had been the center of our extended family. On the tape, you hear me proudly playing for Matt the new Talking Heads song. The whole song is captured on tape. It's unclear if I know I'm being recorded. Matt asks me questions about what was going on, how I felt. It's clear I want to talk and impress my cousin. There are small breaks in the recording that mask the transition. Suddenly, we're outside, walking through the high pasture under 17 pecan trees. The grass crackles and whispers on the tape. Around us are 6-foot-tall white beehives and a collapsed shed that had been a blacksmith shop 100 years ago. The anvil is still sitting in my storage shed in Alabama. I point out the ruined foundations of a disappeared house. Daylilies have spread through the scattered mud-red bricks. We head down a hollow and across the creek. The creek is recorded strongly. To the castle-like mule barn built in the 1920s by a man named Warlick. Whatever his first name now is gone. A giant barn owl roosts in the hayloft. The ground around the barn is choked with dockweed. It's biblical desolation. As we walk up, a groundhog scurries off. In the background, Diva, a 70-pound kuvas, is barking at something, maybe mad, even at this distance. Diva will die that summer of cancer. The morning she died, she woke me up whining. I got up to check on her. She was sprawled on the ground. I lay down beside her in the gray dirt next to a fig tree and held her. She quit whining. That was in the early morning. Only after she died did Debbie and I know. Cancer, Dr. Brahms said. I buried her next to Rua, the long-legged Malamute, who looked like a wolf. Then I make a comparison, which is slow to materialize. I'm not in control on the tape. The comparison is too much for me. At the time, I couldn't see around it, but it's clear now as piece by piece, story by story, the comparison is assembled. Matt doesn't ask the question, but I tell him about the most painful moment of my life. It was Ruoff's death. We had to put him down, lupus I intone. The vet injected him as I held him. It's the right thing, the dog will suffer unnecessarily if you don't. He'll be in constant pain. Ruoff's fur was falling out, leaving big, bald, ulcerated patches. He moaned. He died instantaneously with a jerk. I carried him out of the clinic in my arms. I was covered in his fur. It was in my mouth. I cradled Rua in my arm, Pietà style, in the back of the truck. I buried him facing north with my straw hat over his eyes next to a winter honeysuckle. It was, I say on the tape, the most painful moment of my life, even more than my grandmother's death. Matt knew her. He loved her as if she were his own grandmother. He played harmonica next to her grave after I had finished burying her and smoothing the dirt like frosting on a cake. Matt and Debbie and I were alone after the funeral. Matt never comments. I keep talking. The next piece of the comparison goes on tape. I tell Matt about the farm vet, Doc Boozer's death, and what it felt like. A week before his death, he was at my house talking to me about strawberries. He loved strawberries. At the end of the tape, Matt is talking to AC. AC says flatly, "I have no desire to keep on living." In the background, my grandmother is getting dinner on the table. A chair is scooted across the linoleum. Grass plates clap against the pine table. I can hear a spoon swooshing in an aluminum pot. You can hear, but AC can't hear grandmother calling them to dinner. Matt interrupts AC, "Granddad, it's time to eat. Grandma's calling us." AC replies in what seems to be a drastically different tone, almost a chuckle, "Well, I just come when I'm called. Let's go then." Matt never comments. It seems to be refrigerator dinner, but now I'm not sure what AC hears. The tape cuts off. Back on, Matt is leaving. He's talking to my grandmother, Mary Pullen. "It's still light outside. I want to get home before dark. It's good to see you." You can hear her hugging Matt and the words squeezing together. After that, silence. The humming of the tape sounds like the murmur of animals deep underground. AC wouldn't have heard the same sound. He would have heard the whisper of an ocean stuck in his large ears. I have no desire to keep on living. Did I start a bit late, or should I stop now? What do you think? Small introduction before my students start to read. Not too long ago, I gave a paper assignment. Cece and Sally, who will be reading, were in that class. And a young African-American woman, I'm not sure how old she was, maybe 20, maybe 21, I'm not sure. She grew up in the Fruit Belt. The paper assignment was one page. I got this three-quarters of a page piece of writing, double space. The first paragraph is her attempt to answer my question. And it's as if someone took the sentences and torqued them and twisted them. The grammar, the punctuation, the spelling is all the last part of the paper, suddenly it shifts. And it's as if a seven-year-old girl is writing the paper. A seven-year-old girl is describing growing up in the Fruit Belt. It is lovely. So beautiful. I'm not sure what to do with it. In sociology, aesthetics is not normally a criteria we use to grade. Poetry does not usually enter into my world. But this paper was beautiful. I gave her what I called a devil contract and tried to talk to her after class. I gave her a B on this paper. Tried to talk to her. She was terrified. Would not look at my face. Would not pull her head up in class. But that paper represents in part the other side of what you heard in the first part, while I am not a poet and why I'm not really a good sociologist. What I've tried to do in my sociology is combine it with vocation, the kind of mystery of poetry, the lyricism of poetry, to convey some of the deeper, how would you call it, the deeper power, the deeper, the kind of murmuring underneath representations. So my students, whether they realize it or not, are really kind of pioneers. Some of the critiques of my book that have come out in press already, people are fumbling about to how to describe it. They don't know what it is. They don't know how to say what it is. Someone as heady as Paul Willis, who's one of the major sociologists, in a desperation says, I may be inventing a new style of ethnography. And that's not true at all. I really look back to Walter Benjamin, and in fact, it seems that Graham Gillick is really one of the pressing weights on my work as I try to approximate the mystery that he chases after in his own work. But I think what you'll hear in my students' work is this combination of beauty and powerful social analysis, and that's the difficulty and strain of the kind of work they're trying to do. And so with that, I'm going to give it over to them.
Good afternoon. My name is Watoi Rabi, and I'm going to read an excerpt from a paper that I wrote for Allen last year. It's about my grandfather. My grandfather, or Z as I called him, was pivotal in shaping who I am in the dream world I grew up in as a child. When he passed away, it changed the very shape of my family. He was a missing piece of the puzzle. As a child, he was the man who got up in church and read and talked about the Bible and used to scare me when he pounded his fist on the pew in front of us. I enjoyed reading the Bible. I remember reading it front to back with no recollection or understanding of the stories. So I asked him question upon question, whether we were in church or whether we were in his house. Spending my first semester of school at the house with him and my grandmother gave me a chance to ask him numerous questions. Doing schoolwork with him was always an adventure. I was never worried about getting anything wrong because he was so patient. But I dreaded getting things right because he would poke me in the chest with his large index finger and pound me on the head with his large hand and tell me, that's it, you're correct. As a young child, I never enjoyed doing schoolwork or the lectures that I got that would last forever. But when I was older, the lectures turned into discussions between the two of us. We discussed concepts of church, politics, and life in general over water, matzahs, and matzahs with peanut butter and jelly. Then we would go into his room and watch Democracy Now! I remember going to his library, reading books, and discussing what I read with him. The books that he had were passed down to me now, have been passed down to me now, like the Ouija board, the planchette, and the pictures in Dream Worlds of Alabama. These books are artifacts that hold him close to me. Inside of these books are a constellation of memories that make up a memory palace, and within this palace lie a gateway into my dream world. This is a type of commodity fetishism, fetishization by memory. In Capital, Karl Marx says that at first the commodity may be a trivial thing, but further analysis sheds light on the metaphysical subtleties and theological niceties. These theological niceties and metaphysical subtleties are the dream worlds and memory palaces. When my grandfather was diagnosed with prostate cancer, I was never told directly. I found out through a combination of inference and eavesdropping. This news began to reshape my family. Every day since then, I was plagued with the fear that one day I might lose him. And I did, on his birthday week, ironically. We were all at his house for a birthday party. He had been sick the entire week, and we all decided to take him to a hospital for what we thought would be a simple IV treatment. But the doctor told us otherwise. I hadn't cried so hard or so much since I got my last spanking from him as a child. It took 4 days of waiting, and then it happened. On the fourth night, my uncle and I came back to the hospital, and we noticed a difference in his breath. It was slowed. Then he opened his eyes one last time for one last breath. As I write this passage, I feel myself reaching into a vacuum of nostalgic memory. These books are gateways to the memories of my grandfather. I love my Z. Thank you.
We seem to be on the theme of grandparents, so I'm going to continue it.
So do I.
Oh, I'm Sally F. And I study Spanish and sociology here at Buff State. Taussig said, as people become like things, their dreaming power passes into things that become not only like people, but their persecutors. Things become agents of terror. He also said pilgrimages are no more than implicit networks, smoky trails, manifested but indirectly in the cracks, dreams, and jokes of everyday life. I met my grandmother Mimi when she lived in Ocean City, Maryland, when she was in her 80s. I didn't like her much at all. Her house was boring. It smelled stale. The smell warned me it was not a house for young children, toys, or fun. People moved slowly in the house. Laughter was only polite. Conversation was obligatory, and play could not get too rowdy. The smell emitted out of her hideous old green chair with a stained white blanket over the seat. My grandmother never moved from this chair. She sat in her smelly green chair, situated near the door, a cigarette always in her right hand. Her back was against the door. She had grown up restless in Arkansas. She died when my family was living in her home state, even though she would never admit that that was her home once. I was 6 years old. The trip from Arkansas to Maryland was a long one, especially with small children. We got two adjoined motel rooms somewhere in the Midwest. My five siblings and I were all sleeping in the room with two beds. Two of my older brothers slept on cots. My other two brothers slept on a double bed, and I slept with my little sister. The door connected to the rooms remained open. I could hear my siblings breathing deeply, dreaming around me. I lied next to my sister, who was grinding her teeth in her sleep. They were all familiar, peaceful sounds. But later that night, I heard something foreign and disorienting. I heard deep, quiet weeping in the next room. It had never occurred to me that my father was capable of crying until that very moment when I was 6 years old in the dark, in the shadow. I didn't see him, but I imagined that he was sitting on the edge of his bed. He was probably working on his eulogy because the funeral was the next day. He probably thought he was completely alone. After the funeral, we were allowed to go through my grandmother's house to find something that would remind us of her. I didn't know her at all. It was strange walking through her house, her ugly chair still in position, knowing that I could select whatever I wanted to take home with me. My brothers gawked at the swordfish hanging over the ceiling. She had a chess table and strange figurines that looked like they were from India, even though I had no idea. Nothing interested me. There were no toys. On her dresser, there was a beautiful wooden jewelry box. I had never seen anything so pretty. It could spin around and hold rings, necklaces, earrings, and whatever else I would like to place there. I didn't have any jewelry when I received the box, but I carried the jewelry box out of that room carefully and proudly. I heard my mom tell my dad when I was in the other room that she couldn't believe he gave me that box. She had wanted it. But Dad, she's going to break it, my brothers warned. I smiled and looked at my acquisition in my grandmother's home with joy. We got back to Arkansas, and I put the jewelry box on my dresser. I spinned it around slowly, looking admiringly at the dark red wood. The jewelry box made me less scary. Her memory became pretty. I almost felt like I knew her. The jewelry box moved with us to Mimi's state and into Indiana. My mother and I had spent the day unpacking boxes. I brought a cardboard box into my room. It was too heavy for me, so I carelessly slid it onto my dresser. It pushed Mimi's jewelry box, and it dived gracefully, exploding into pieces like fireworks on my wooden floor. I was shocked that it had broken into so many individual pieces. The wooden jewelry box was not made out of fine wood. The wood underneath was processed light brown and grainy. The box was only thinly covered with a prettier wood. I wondered if I could put it together with glue. It would be like a puzzle. I frantically found my mom, but nothing could be done. The jewelry box was destroyed. She gave me a smaller box and said that she was sorry. I put the pieces in the box and took it to the trash. I examined each piece of wood in disbelief. that such cheap wood composed my jewelry box. I had thought it to be expensive and fine. It was dark outside when I walked to the end of the driveway, my bare feet feeling the grainy cement. Mosquitoes were out. Under the streetlights of my neighborhood street, I placed the box next to the bins of garbage. I sat down and stared at the pieces. In the silence and in the company of the other boxes of garbage, I sat. I felt stupid for breaking my grandmother's box. I was too young to have such fine things, I thought to myself, but staring at the pieces, I remembered it wasn't fine. Her ghost returned and the lump in my throat, and I felt the soft tears that had taken 3 years to cry. The jewelry box made me feel like I had a relationship with her, and that she loved me too. But underneath, there was nothing but cheap wood, easily shattered. I wanted to feel the deep loss from my father's mother. I wanted to see the beautiful wood break uniquely and originally. I wanted to keep a piece to remember her, but they were little pieces carelessly glued together in the first place. No matter how many times I returned my gaze to the broken pieces of the box, it remained the same. There was nothing there for me. There is no stopping point, no single sheet of water to arrive at, but water like memory in endless shapes, sheets of mica to be peeled off layer by layer. Mimi made it her life's work to cover herself up and keep people away. I have many stopping places in the memories, but nothing ends my curiosity and mystery of my grandmother, whose face looks like mine. Mimi is a mysterious city at the end of an excavation where I will never arrive. This space of death is preeminently a space of transformation. Through the experience of coming close to death, there well may be a more vivid sense of life. Through fear, there can come not only a growth in self-consciousness, but also fragmentation.
Feels surrounded by a pack of enemies who are all after him. This is his basic experience. It is most clearly expressed in the vision of eyes. He sees eyes everywhere and all around him. They are interested only in him, and their interest is menacing in the extreme. The creatures to whom the eyes belong intend to take their revenge on him. Kanagi, 457. I'm sitting in world history class, learning about something that happened over 100 years ago. A sweat beating on my forehead, hands clenched and clammy, thumbs twiddling like a nervous old lady. I can feel all 23 eyes, watching and listening in on the thoughts swarming my mind. I try to take a breath, just like now, but it does not come. Thoughts racing through my mind, colliding with each other. My chest feels the way it must when someone is about to have a massive heart attack. Oh no, I must be having a heart attack. My hand shoots up into the air before I can think about what I'm about to say. I need to go see the nurse. The words become one syllable. I need to say it fast before I actually let myself think. If nobody was watching me before, they sure as hell are now. Now they really know how fucked up I am. While I'm sitting in the nurse's office, I realize that it is lunchtime and just know that Crazy Cassie is the top of the lunch table. When I get downstairs to the nurse's office, I tell her friendly face that I just wanted to go home. Nothing else, no explanations. I call my mother. She picks up after two rings. And I tell her what I have just told the school nurse. She's at my school in about 20 minutes. After signing me out, we walk to the car. After we get into the car, after the doors are closed and no one else can hear our conversation, she asks, "What's wrong, Cass?" I respond with a non-answer, "Nothing." She knows this is a lie because I was in the nurse's office, a place I became all too familiar with throughout that year. But she just told me to make an appointment with my pediatrician. I make the appointment for whatever date would cure me of my heart problems the fastest. I go into my doctor's office, expecting him to prescribe me some pills, but instead he makes me talk to him, something I don't like to do. He decides that what is best for me is to meet with a therapist who is good with people in my age bracket. I give in and get her number so I can add another doctor to my pantheon. This is where Martha comes in. Martha is the therapist I saw at the time. I'm convinced she is in love with me. She explains to me that I have anxiety and panic disorder. Oh, goody, something to add to my list of things which are wrong with me. I go to her office on a Tuesday afternoon, right after school lets out. So I'm sitting there in my Catholic schoolgirl uniform. I'm just as anxious as I was in world history class. I know she's not going to help me. My last therapist didn't do anything for me. So why should this woman? I'm only there to appease my parents and my pediatrician. I hear my name, Cassandra, except the woman doesn't pronounce it right. Bitch. I follow behind my parents. She wants to speak to them as well. We talk about why I'm there. I don't know why the fuck I'm there. But I lie, which is something I became all too good at in situations such as this. We talk for a good hour and then schedule an appointment for that Thursday. I spend every Tuesday and Thursday there for the next 4 months. I hated going there. I would be in tears after every session. Once I even convinced my dad to get me fries from McDonald's. Those were the only things that were going to make me happy. In the end, I guess I was too fucked up for Martha, because she said that she would prescribe me some pills to cure my anxiety. I didn't want to take any more pills. I was already taking the same amount as my grandfather. That was when I quit. I wasn't getting any better. So I ended up things with Martha. She tried to help me. I know she did. I guess I just didn't want the help, especially from a woman with bad hair. Even with all the help from Martha, my parents, and everyone else who cares about me, this anxiety just doesn't want to leave. It is like the sister I never had. Always there, especially when I don't want her to be. But being there for me and understanding me like no one else can. I call her Emily.
I'm an English major at Upstate. The mark on her leg peered at me like a child hiding behind a door. It was a big burn mark, raw and soft. I thought about touching it, but I didn't want it to stick to my finger like gum. What happened to you? I asked, curiously, as we sat on her bed. Oh, I was making rice, the pot fell over, and all the water spilled on my leg, she said very plainly. I stared at her as she continued doing her homework. That looks pretty bad for it to be a water burn, I said, matter-of-factly poking at her words. She looked up slowly, apprehensively, like a child caught lying and stepping out from behind a door, with eyes low to the ground. Okay, I'll tell you the truth. She spoke in a low whisper with fear so sharp it cut my skin like blades. She was afraid they would hear her. It was as if her lightly spoken words would crawl and seep through the thin layer of reality that permeated her household and into the other side, where Papa Candelo awaited and watched her every move. About a month prior to the event, Jasmine lost her virginity to Ricky. He was a pot dealer and everyone knew it. We'd stay up all night when I slept over, talking about her experiences, sucking dick and getting fucked. When her brother-in-law Eddie came over, she ran to him like an overachieving student with the news of good grades. Guess what? We did it. I gave him my virginity. His eyes rolled out of his head and onto the floor next to her, except she didn't notice because she was in the clouds, floating in her love story. Eddie came over the night of her burn. In fact, he put it there. The family sat around the living room talking. Suddenly, Eddie se montó. The beads of protection sat around his neck. They were blessed by the Santero and the Botanica. His eyes rolled to the back of his head as he rocked back and forth. His characteristics began to show. They knew who had arrived. Papa Candelo. Jasmine stood in the circle. You have lied to your parents. You are not a virgin. His voice boomed in the living room, and the mirrored walls shook with his power. Above where he sat stood the framed picture of Jasmine in her first communion, her hands clutching the Holy Bible and her head looking up towards the sky in her pearly white dress. Liar! He yelled as he opened a ring of fire around her. Her parents cried and her sisters watched quietly, stunned. The fire danced around her like the brujos dancing to their saints, chanting and shaking with his every word. She cried and begged for forgiveness. The fire grew around her, isolating her from her family. She tried to escape as the flames calmed. They kissed her skin, passionately going up her toes and like a mini explosion swallowing up her foot. Suddenly, it all disappeared. Eddie calmed down and the spirit left him sitting weak and exhausted. Jasmine stood on the ground, her mark exposed as a sign of the sin she committed. Don't tell anyone, she said, almost crying. I won't tell, I said. And I meant it because I never did tell anyone. I was too scared Papa Candela would burn me in my sleep. I never judged nor did I understand the religion of Santeria, just like I didn't understand any other religion or belief. My mother stopped going to church after divorcing my father. I guess she no longer had to prove herself to my grandparents, a devoted Pentecostal couple. Abuela y Abuelo would run a marathon with their canes, clutching their bad, nearly broken legs if God asked them to. Jasmine's house was wild. Her mother was very different than mine. She burned candles for saints to help her with her troubles. My mother filled the bathtub with water and tried to drown in it. They were what Michael Tauzig describes as highland shaman, acting as a medium of spirits and of a culture whose roots lay deep in a history of a religious melting pot. Their stories incarnating the ghosts of religions dead as their saints. We were stuck in a case of fortune and misfortune, trying to solve what couldn't be undone.
My name's Wendy. This is a quote from the New York Times, April 20th, 1899. In the presence of President McKinley and his wife, members of his cabinet, three generations of Ulysses S. Grant's family, and a great crowd of people, Miss Rosemary Sartoris, granddaughter of General Grant, today unveiled a heroic equestrian statue of her grandfather in Fairmount Park. There is an absence of dramatic action, the attitude of the general being indicative of deep thought. He is clad in field garb with high cavalry boots, closed button coat, and a long cape or coat which falls in folds over the horse. The horse stands firmly on his 4 feet, with head turned slightly to one side. The total cost was $32,675.35. Mom started calling Dad the General after he and my brother started the anti-anxiety drug Lexapro. She thinks he's the reincarnation of Ulysses S. Grant. She also thinks that she is a reincarnation of Rosemary Sartoris, and my brother was grandson, Brigadier General Frederick D. Grant. I asked my mother who I was in this Civil War family. She nonchalantly responded, "Oh, you're not in that family." While the General and Brigadier General were on Lexapro and Rosemary was on blood pressure medication, I sat in the office of a middle-aged man. The lines in his forehead were indicative of deep thought. He is clad in medical field garb, New Balance sneakers with arch support, pristine white laboratory coat, and a pen with the brand name drug Xanax on its side. He wants to be my hero, to tell me he understands my pain. I've got cuts in my arms indicative of deep thought too, Doc. I arrived at their house to see Dad sitting upon his trusty steed, a red tractor. He was clad in Dad garb, rust-colored red-winged boots, a Viking's t-shirt, and a cigar which poured folds of smoke that hovered inside the cement garage. Mom says they look exactly alike, and these days I cannot remember the specific faults I had with that notion. I think of Dad most often when I'm at work and come across $50 bills. Sometimes I draw an eye patch on the general's face with a counterfeit pen and laugh. When customers ask why I do that, I just say, it's too long of a story. Though I'm not certain that I believe my mom about the three of them being a reincarnated Civil War family, sometimes I find the same solace that I'm sure she does in this fantasy. Who cares that Daddy is on anti-anxiety medication? Who cares that Mom was overweight and was willing to have his stomach shrunk to hold only 50 cc's of food? Who cares that my brother cannot hold a steady job, find a good girlfriend, or pay his rent? It doesn't matter because in the past life they were all heroes. When they die and are cut open, maybe, just underneath the residue of Lexapro, the doctors will find some hidden link to the 1800s. Maybe Daddy will die of throat cancer from all those cigars, just like the general did. And maybe Mom will be buried with sweet peas.
Thank you. door. I kind of have a problem where I never finish essays, so I didn't really feel that I had anything to read, so I just kind of went to my notebook and tried to like take a series of punchlines and put them together. And then also, for those that are involved, just kind of in the background of this, as I kind of put these things together, I'm reading in the metro and having espresso with Alan at the cafe in the morning. The hourglass. We sit on her bed in the small bedroom in the back corner of the apartment. Where are we going? What are we doing? Us? Me, probably grad school. Her, she just needs to get. She is stuck and doesn't know what move to make next. A shelf is hung on the wall, running along the bed. Some books, including Deepak Chopra and The Time Traveler's Wife. Miscellaneous cosmetics, a bottle of shampoo and a bottle of conditioner, and several brands and flavors of lotion. An unused guitar, never played, sits across the room. She reached for the lotion, squeezed a dollop into her hand, and massaged it in. Second one I call the unseen. I traveled downtown to City Campus to review her presentation on Chapter 1 at Capitol. The commodity fetish gives her the most trouble. She reads me a wordy definition from Wikipedia, and then a definition from a textbook that mentions exchange value and alienation. I try and explain. She replies back to me, "In your paper, the non-dairy coffee creamer isn't about the creamer. It's what happens because of the creamer. The creamer's like a metaphor. It's what's going on behind the creamer." I respond with, "Exactly, so you understand." But she shakes her head no. The problem isn't that she can't understand the commodity fetish. It's that she doesn't believe in ghosts. Dump truck driving. Driving big trucks, diesel engine, 9, 10, and 12 gear trucks, requires the operator, when shifting, to synchronize the speed of the transmission with the RPMs of the engine in order to change gears. It requires skill and dexterity, unlike in a car where the shift is synchronized by bands inside the transmission. The clutch is disengaged, gear selector moved to neutral while the engine speed drops 400 to 500 revolutions per minute, and then the operator slides it into the next gear. 25 RPMs too high or low in the gears grind. This singular shift, done 9 times up and 9 times down, each time the truck is stopped and started, is further complicated by a bump in the road, disturbing the operator's pressure on the accelerator pedal, complicated by a suspension seat moving up and down with the truck, changing the position of the driver's legs, and further complicated by ascending or descending grade, requiring an adjustment of engine speed to accommodate for the increase or decrease in wheel speed. I can perform this operation 3,000 times in a workday, never miss a gear, never grind, constantly playing with a cigarette, the radio, and talking on the phone. It just happens. I feel the intensity of the vibration of the truck, and all my moves just flow as if it's instinct. I'm tuned into the truck. In first gear at 1950 RPMs, I go about 2 miles an hour. In ninth gear, I'm moving at 58 miles per hour. At this speed, it would take me 5 hours to drive to Albany. But I don't need a clock. Time is kept by the engine. Waiting for the bus. Tick, 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 tick. Standing, cold and rainy, parking lot, waiting for the bus. I've never seen the lady standing next to me. I'm plugged into my iPod. I look up, the bus emerges over the hill and is coming towards us. I look at my phone, 9:41. 9:41, right on time. Tick, 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 tick. This lady, The only thing keeping us here together, tick, 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 tick. The only thing keeping us together, tick, 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 ghost world. I ran first thing this morning. It was frigid. Ice formed on my mustache. I felt my heart. Beep, 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 beep. It ruins it when Pat looks at me, when Pat looks at his Garmin and tells me we're running a 7:08 pace per mile. In the kitchen, I have 5 jars turned upside down on a stainless steel rack. The big one has sunflower seeds, 2 have mung bean seeds, 1 with buckwheat, and 1 with radish seeds. I rinse them with Brita water when I get up and before I go to bed. The radish sprouts first, then the buckwheat, then the mung beans, and finally the sunflower seeds. When sprouted, I put them in the fridge in little glad plastic containers and eat them before they rot. Then I fill the jars again. It's tough to run and eat healthy. There just isn't enough time in the day. Thanks.
Hi, my name is Nick, and I'm going to sort of bring it back to the deceased grandparents. When they had made plans for the wake and the funeral, the family slowly broke down. My mother, Pat, and Kay had agreed to go to the house on the beach to find their insurance papers, and maybe memories earlier, but it's locked away in a chest. Old blankets and sheets covered up his old uniform that looked tiny compared to me. I had went with them, but had stopped at Arby's to pick up some food. They were running out of roast beef, so they weren't filling.
Nick, can you be a little louder?
Oh. Inside the chest, on little shelves connected to the lid, were shelves with a red and gold replica gun. Next to that was a water pistol that looked, in color-wise, a cheap version of the replica gun. There were cards next to this compartment. They were between my grandparents. They were store bought cards that had been handwritten over years of happiness and love. She called him Punk. On the end were coins he had collected, mostly bicentennial quarters and Kennedy half dollars. There's a small brown envelope that held 2 old Indian pennies from 1903 and 1907. I had a 2008 penny in my pocket. I had placed it in the envelope and put it back where it had laid. 105 years of history was in my hands. Pennies are meaningless nowadays. This was a former plant room in the attic, which when Kate owned the house. It was now designated a computer room. And now this. The de-evolution of the room was nice to see. The plants are long gone, and it's a hollow room. There were old cabinets that had displayed light bulbs. When looking for his legal papers, we'd encountered 3 key operating safes, the first 2 opened easily, containing past bills and a joke menu of prices of women's genitalia. It was safely kept, unwrinkled, and preserved, a reminder of his Navy days. The third one had no key present. I decided to break it open. Into his basement, I ducked. Underneath the spiderwebs that had grown in the hallways. I went to his tool cabinet that had hung open like an old hungry monster. I grabbed an old wooden handle hammer and a similar type of screwdriver. That screwdriver alone was all that was needed to pop the lid. Old papers from insurance companies were on top of a ring box that had held a pink stone and a golden ring. I'd assumed it belonged to my grandmother. The silver pocket watch. The silver pocket watch he'd gotten from Bethlehem Steel was next to it in a black cloth. My grandfather now becomes a fixture in a family album. The people that greet him into life are all long since deceased. His world is finally domesticated once and for all. Once upon a time, George Punk Mychek was a global being in the Navy fighting in the Pacific for World War II. Then he was back to Buffalo with his work in Bethlehem Steel that had helped him figuratively across the nation, but at the same time encouraged the hearing loss that would later isolate him. After the death of his wife, his life was dedicated to church and children. He was known for his work in finishing the pews. On one now is scratch an anarchist A. During the funeral, the priest spoke of that, how he used an old trick with glass to remove the previous stain and avoided it damaging the wood. The church is large for a suburban church. It hangs above the I-90. The inside of it has the pews that were just mentioned flanking the center and left of the altar. A gray carpet covers the altar and the organ. I'd helped decorate this place one Christmas years ago. I stood atop a one-sided ladder that leaned against a wooden wall that identified the main church and the chapel. I just attached a strand of garland to an already there nail, my grandfather standing below me as if to protect me from a fall. I told him that I needed to move about 5 feet to the left to reach the next nail. He decided to help me by pushing the ladder the necessary distance while I remained perched atop. I try to bookmark memories like this as to keep my grandfather active in my memory.
Right, that's everybody, right? Right, a round of applause for our students. Okay, so I really want to thank Alan. Thank you, Alan, for coming today and reading. And of course, these guys are awesome, so I was very touched by all of your readings, so thank you for sharing with us. I should make an announcement, or maybe Molly wants to say something about the event that's next at 6:30. About the next event? The event that's at the Birchfield?
Tomorrow night at the Birchfield.
I thought it was tonight.
Karen Engel, Graham Gilded, John Wynn, a local Buffalo boy done good, and Petra Leithman from Toronto on Robert Hirsch's World in a Jar exhibition, which is that long strand, DNA strand of 1,000-plus sampled photographs. Dominates the east side of the gallery. So that's at
6
o'clock.
Tomorrow night.
Tomorrow. I thought it was night, sorry. Great. That was great. If you guys could just help me to get the room back in order. We just need to bring the tables back and put the chairs back around and move the sofas so they face each other here. And the students are here if anyone has questions for them or Alan. Thanks, Alan.